This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As world leaders meet, the best scientific predictions seriously underestimate how extreme weather will be even just a couple of decades ahead. Who says so? Five scientists from University of Oxford, University of Edinburgh, and lead author Chris O'Reilly, now from University of Exeter. They find even the best projections are too tame for extreme weather events in the 2040s, especially for the U.S. Northeast and Northern European winters. The chances of more extreme seasons, including summer heat and drought, are also increasing as the planet warms. Dr. Christopher O'Reilly is Royal Society Research Fellow at the University of Reading's Department of Meteorology. Chris O'Reilly, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Nice to join you.
Well, here on the ground, we humans experience seasons year by year, but scientists can see those longer cycles that we don't. Chris, your new paper was published in September 20th, 2021, but we won't really understand anything about it unless we get the first two words of the paper right, and those are internal variability. What do you mean by that?
Internal variability covers a range of features in the climate system, so that can be things like ocean currents, atmospheric dynamics, and it's the atmospheric dynamics that we're really focused on in this paper. So that's the year-to-year changes in wind speeds and the way that they affect the weather. And in many ways, it's really analogous to what we experience every day. We know that, for example, if you live in the UK, in the winter, if you get winds coming from the east, we know it's going to be cooler. Now, on a year-to-year basis and then on longer timescales, these things aren't quite as extreme, but they affect the climate anomalies that we experience at the surface in the same way. In our study, the internal variability is really referring to variability in the winds in the atmosphere.
And what brought your team to question predictions from even the best climate models?
So it's a slight subtlety, and this is something that has been covered in some other papers previously. One of the things is that actually it's not that the models are completely wrong. So when I say it's a slight subtlety, what I mean is that it's the decadal variability in the winds that really aren't picked up by the models. Now, we have to be slightly humble here, because when we look at the observational record, we've got a limited observational record. When we look at a couple of climate models, we can run them for as long as we like on big computers, and we can get good statistics that we understand. Whereas what actually happens is when we look at the observations, we don't have quite as many statistics. However, there are some conclusions that we can draw, and one is that in the extratropics, so that's in the mid-latitudes basically, the decadal variance in wind in these regions tends to be much larger in the observational record that we have compared to what we see in the couple climate models.
And one of the most impressive Earth system models is the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology Grand Ensemble 35. What is that? And do those model results get used by actual policymakers?
Yes. So that's one of the models that is used commonly within the climate community. So these models go into things like the IPCC assessment reports and these kinds of things. Specifically, the Max Planck Institute Grand Ensemble is quite unique in that it's 100 members. So basically what they've done is they've taken a single model and they've integrated it forward, but by changing the initial conditions, you get 100 different realizations, if you like, of what we could expect. And when they do this with a particular model, what you tend to do is try to run a historical simulation, which will start sometime in the past. You force it with things like external forcing that we think we can estimate pretty accurately. These are things like greenhouse gas concentrations, solar forcing, even volcanic eruptions, these types of things. And then you can also integrate it into the future following particular climate scenarios. The unique thing about this grand ensemble that has 100 members is exactly that. It's that it's got 100 members. So we can really get quite a consistent forced picture. So basically, by averaging over all of these 100 members, what we actually do is you can average out the internal variability. So you can really separate what we think is the internal variability from what is the forced change in the model, or forced changes in time, going back in time, but also then going into the future.
Well, I have to be honest, your paper is not easy. It's not really for public consumption. Some of the methods employed are beyond most of us, but we can build some trust because your group cross-checked a multitude of model runs against a record from hard observational data from the past 100 years. Where does that observational data come from?
So most of the observational data that we use in this paper comes from sea level pressure observations. So these are basically barometer observations taken at weather stations. And these are the same types of observations that you could take if you have a barometer in your kitchen or in your house, right? These things are quite old instruments in a way. The nice thing about taking observations from sea level pressure is that sea level pressure has a large spatial scale to it. So we don't think that there's too much noise in the record. Now, of course, we have to be quite humble and careful about, you know, going back further in time. As you go back further in time, there's less observations. Less reliable is probably the wrong way to think about it, but there tends to be less of them, so we can constrain the variability maybe less on longer time scales. But it's sea level pressure observations that we really rely on, and these are just taken from barometers.
And did I get this right? Are global climate models more wrong about winters than summers, and does that matter?
They are, in a sense, yes. So you are right there, yeah. One of the problems is that in the winter, there is a large amount of decadal variability in the large-scale circulation. So these are the winds and how they vary from decade to decade. And we can infer this from sea level pressure. That's one of the kind of strengths of sea level pressure, is that if we know the sea level pressure field, that gives us a really good handle on what's called the geostrophic wind. So on longer timescales, the wind is in geostrophic balance. So from the sea level pressure, we can do a good job of inferring what the wind speed's doing.
Are we more wrong about winters and summers, and does that matter?
Well, it's not that the models, they are actually, yes. The bottom line is that they are, and the reason is that the wind advection has a larger impact on surface climate in the winter. The variability is underestimated in the summer as well as the winter. However, it has a bigger impact in winter. But we have to also be humble and say that there are potentially things that we're missing in the summer. So I wouldn't confidently say that this isn't a problem in the summer. I would just say that from our study, we couldn't demonstrate that it would be as big an issue as it is in the winter.
You know, another subject that I've seen you work on in other papers is teleconnection. It involves teleconnection, and the public doesn't understand much about this. To be frank, I don't understand a lot about it. What are teleconnections, and how have you used them in your science?
So teleconnections, they can mean two things. They're often in the literature, people refer to remote teleconnections. These are effectively where you get something happening in one area of the climate system that can affect circulation in another area. And when we say circulation, what we really mean is the winds and the impact that they will have on climate at the surface. I guess the most famous teleconnection would be the teleconnection to the extratropics from the El Niño Southern Oscillation. So this is where patterns of convection shift in the tropics, and this affects winds in the extratropics. What it does is it changes where you get outflow in the upper level of the troposphere, and that shifts the winds in the extratropics. And that's what ultimately controls the link between the El Niño and climate and, well, weather in the United States. So it's that kind of link between something happening in one place and shifting winds in another place. But it's not limited to these tropical to extratropical teleconnections. There are examples, for example, when we get anomalies in the stratosphere. As I know you've had guests thinking about the stratosphere recently on your show. When you get anomalies in the stratosphere, they can effectively sort of percolate down and affect winds in the troposphere as well. And that is in some way a teleconnection as well.
Yeah, in 2017, I spoke with Ivana Sivanovic. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And she was one of five scientists at Lawrence Livermore National Lab who found that the future loss of Arctic sea ice cover could drive a substantial decrease in California's rainfall. And she explained what she called a double teleconnection. And putting it in my words, a temperature change in the Arctic altered air in the Pacific, and that changed rains over California like a chain reaction. It sounds pretty complicated out there in the atmosphere, Chris.
Yes, these things are complicated. They're particularly complicated because of, I mean, the example you've just said, I'm not completely familiar exactly with that work in detail. The problem is you can see when there's kind of two things going on, it's not just knowing how one thing influences another. We kind of need to model these things correctly. We need to get the exact strength right, because then the strength of the secondary connection then will matter. So these are the kind of complicated things. And we're asking models to do this, which is exactly the right thing to do. You know, because they should have all of the physics built into them. But these are slight things that we don't think are quite right in models can have a knock-on effect on through these kind of teleconnections and links you're describing. So these things are complicated. That's not to say that we, you know, shouldn't try to understand them, but also maybe that we should retain some humility in doing so.
And how solid are these principles of teleconnection? Do some scientists doubt or discount long-range interactions in the atmosphere like that?
I don't think there's too many scientists necessarily doubt them. There's certainly active research going on in various areas. One example would be the paper that we recently had published that you were talking about earlier. In that paper, we found that there's very weak decadal variability in the large-scale circulation, but we don't really understand exactly where this would come from. We think that it's potentially linked to the fact that in even seasonal forecast models, teleconnections, the predictable teleconnections, are very weak in models. So what you find is that models can predict teleconnections in a skillful way, but actually they don't predict the magnitude of these quite as well as they should. And we think that this is likely linked to this, the models having weak variability on longer timescales. So there is a kind of a pattern here of some consistent issues with modelling these teleconnections, but actually there's kind of the answer as to why is not totally clear. So there's many interesting kind of ongoing research questions in this area.
Well, yes, on your new paper on built-in variability of climate, the key question is, how can we know if wild weather we experience is new as opposed to the cold, heat, or storms reported in old newspapers and journals? How do we know that our pollution of the atmosphere has made weather more extreme?
There's two things there. One is a purely empirical basis, and there's growing evidence empirically by just looking at the data. And the second thing, I think, is that most of these predictions are interpretations of more extreme weather are based on physical principles that we understand well. And a simple example of this is looking at observations of extreme rainfall, but also looking at observations of humidity in the atmosphere. As we're warming the planet, the atmosphere is holding more water. That's what we expect from fairly elementary physics now, really. We expect that. And then as a result, we expect that there can be more extreme rainfall. So these are kind of basic things that not only do we think we understand it from, or can we kind of imply it from the data, but also it's based on fundamental physical principles, which I think we all want to do our science based on physical principles, not just on data analysis or anything like that. So I really think that whilst this, you know, you can probably find some extremes that aren't getting worse, possibly, if you hunt around. Most of the extremes that are getting worse, we understand based on physical principles, things that we would expect from warming the planet due to more CO2.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Christopher O'Reilly, University of Reading. We are investigating destabilized weather in the Northern Hemisphere during the coming decades. Your team also looks at extreme seasons. How do you define an extreme season?
This is an extension of the method that kind of came out of our approach. We defined an extreme season very simply as a 1-in-20-year event over a recent climatological period. So it was basically just over a recent period, what was the wettest or warmest season that we occurred, or the coolest season or the driest season. So these kind of 1-in-20-year events that are easily empirically measured.
Did some parts of the Northern Hemisphere just go through an extreme season in this summer of 2021?
I'm very sure that they did. Yes, I suppose they did, didn't they? Particularly in North America. So I suppose Canadian wildfires and warm temperatures in Canada, I suppose, would have qualified as that.
We saw heat that we've never seen before, absolutely off the record. And in fact, just last week, it was 100 degrees at the end of September in North Dakota, which is just crazy talk. It's the hottest temperature ever recorded that far north that late in the season. So we're still setting records as we go along here. Now, what makes you think in coming decades we will go beyond extreme events in the mid-latitudes to entire extreme seasons, or did I get that right?
So I think in our analysis, we weren't really looking at individual extreme events on a kind of a weekly or two-weekly timescale, because our method was really just looking at these seasonal anomalies. We were only looking at so this is why it's kind of loosely, you know, it's not extreme in the sense that of flooding and things, it's extreme in the sense of over a whole season, do you expect it to be warmer, warmer than, you know, any year in the last 20 years. So that's the kind of, those are the kind of extremes that we were talking about in this paper.
Has there been time for the modeling community to respond to the problems you and your colleagues raise?
Well, I think it's, I would say that the problems that we raise, in some ways we're not raising them directly. These are, some of these aspects are kind of known about before, and these are ongoing problems. One of our real focuses in the paper was to try to understand, well, okay, if models aren't getting enough decadal variability, what does that mean for future projections? And we really wanted to just kind of work out, okay, well, what are we really missing here? And we were able to show that there's substantial future uncertainty that is probably underestimated in the current models.
Two of your team are from the University of Edinburgh, and I wonder, should we presume world leaders at the Edinburgh Climate Summit at the end of October will be still using model projections that underestimate how extreme weather could become in the coming decades?
Well, again, I would say that we're looking at extreme future climates here. We're looking at kind of the uncertainty in projecting kind of longer term climate. I think it's probably fair to say that if you zoom out from this particular study, that we do need to be a bit cautious and a bit humble about what our modelling efforts can show, and actually, you know, being cautious, because we go beyond the realm of science into policy decisions, but I do think, you know, these things have to be taken seriously, and thinking about worst possible outcomes and trying to plan for them is really a prudent thing to do, and accepting that maybe things that are outside of our current model range could be that could be possible. I think planning for those things would be a prudent thing to do.
You know, it seems like with every paper and interview I do, the future looks more murky and more unstable than we thought. It's generally climate change is worse than we thought. Am I just calling the wrong scientists?
No, well, I don't think you are. I would actually say, though, Alex, that our paper that we've just had published, in some ways this is quite balanced on the sense of kind of what could be more extreme. If what we're really saying is that the uncertainty is probably underestimated, so actually things are more uncertain than we think. So that could be, for example, in the Northern Hemisphere winters, we could get, things could not be much warmer or much wetter than we expect. We could get much drier than we expect. In some sense, our paper is quite neutral on these things, but equally they could be warmer than models are currently predicting. So it's, yeah, I suppose we could get lucky and it could not be so bad, but I don't think that's a great policy decision, is it really? Even if that's what we might be doing.
I think so. You know, the fact that we are doing such a grand experiment and things become so uncertain, right there should be setting off a lot of alarms, in my opinion. Just that, not necessarily that we know that we're doomed or we're not, but that the fact that we don't know.
That's more or less where I see, Alex. I don't think there's nothing to be gained by being overly, some people refer to it as doomerism. There's nothing to be gained by that, but equally there is an element of waking up and being cautious and preparing for the worst. People do this all the time in their everyday lives. You know, people have house insurance and things, right, in case the worst happens, or life insurance and all these kinds of things. The idea that people wouldn't prepare for the worst when it comes to the climate is probably a bit silly. So,
from the Department of Meteorology at the University of Reading, we've been talking with Royal Society University Research Fellow Christopher O'Reilly. Find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you for talking with us. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.